Our main speaker tonight is Snow.
My name is Snow, and I am an alcoholic. Yeah, I don't want that to be in my nose. I want to say welcome to all the newcomers. Welcome home. Welcome home. How do you stop dancing with a 1,000-pound gorilla? You get something bigger than the gorilla. You just found something bigger than the gorilla. And in my experience, it works. Alcoholics Anonymous is the most phenomenal place on earth. What makes me an alcoholic? I have an allergy to alcohol. When I drink, I can't stop. And I was the last one to find out. And my sobriety date is March 7, 1975. Now, I'm allergic to clams, too, but I haven't had to go to meetings for 34 years for my clam problem. This is a disease that centers in the mind, and that's where I have to keep the mental housekeeping. I have to keep coming back here to keep the house clean, to fill it up with the God part, to get the solution. The inside of me was one big God-shaped hole that I tried to fill with alcohol, cigarettes, bad boys, and all kinds of things. And there was nothing I could ever do to make that shape go away until I came here. And the good people of Alcoholics Anonymous loved me sober every minute. And you can get loved sober, too, if you just keep coming back here. The trick is just don't pick up one drink and you can't get drunk. Amazing, astounding information that I heard when I came here. I had a perfectly normal life up until the age of 6 months old. At that point, my parents went off the deep end. My siblings went into an orphanage. And a kindly neighbor brought me to a relative who worked in Cotman's Bakery in the East Bronx. And I began my journey with some loving, wonderful people who were kind and generous, who never adopted me. And that feeling of not belonging any place was with me my whole life until I crawled in here. I had lots of drinks when I was young. My social drinking was 7 to 9 years old. I got busted shoplifting doll's clothes at 9 years old. I was smoking at 11 and falling down drunk on my face at 14 years old. I remember having a hot toddy when I had a sore throat, which was whiskey and honey and all kinds of goodies in there. And it was Christmas time. And I tell you, that Santa Claus was winking at me. This tinsel on the tree was dancing. And I belonged with this family. They had a son and a daughter, 10 and 15 years older than me. And it was like Ozzie and Harriet, you know. And I was the weird Puerto Rican kid in this Italian family. But I belonged when I had that hot toddy. And so I used to get sick a lot. And one day I lit the thermometer, and I don't know, everything's digital now, but when you take a match to a thermometer with mercury in it, it flies all over the place. And that's when I started lying about, you know, what I was up to. But the alcohol made me feel better. It just made me feel good inside, and that's why I drank. It changed the way I felt, changed the way I saw the whole world. It changed the way that I thought people saw me. It made me everything I wasn't. I forgot my story, Peg. I remember at 14 years old, I just wanted that oblivion. I used to go to visit, they'd take me to see my siblings in the orphanage, and I had this like little white dress on. You know, it was only a $2 dress from Alexander's, but I always felt like I was the survivor. I had that survivor's guilt, and I would scream and cry, and then I was afraid they were going to leave me. I had all this fear and guilt and shame, and then I went to Catholic school, and You know, that just compounded the whole thing. I got a nice little magazine in seventh grade once, and I wanted to get this really cool hairdo, and I copied it, and I was sitting in the front of the church, and Sister Georgiana came and dragged me out of the church, calling, screaming at me, a beatnik, that I was a beatnik. And, you know, and I was sitting there praying for that miracle. I'd watch that 10-inch TV in the tenement on the fourth floor, sit there, that little black and white TV, and I watched that the movie with the little children of Fatima, and I'd pray for the miracle that they had. I wanted a miracle. Please give me a miracle. And then I'd watch Myrna Loy, the thin man, and I wanted those martinis that they had, and the tuxedos. The guys were always dressed, and women were in silk dresses, and, you know, topper, and everything was so elegant. I wanted my life to be elegant. And in 1956, they broadcast the Olympics for the first time, and I sat there watching the ice skater. And I said, how do you get there from here? There was nobody to ask. I felt like other people got the map, and I never got the map. You know, my parents were who raised me never got out of sixth grade. They were kind people, very kind people, but I couldn't ask them anything. There were no directions. I tried to get them to adopt me legally. They never could. They didn't want to upset my real parents, and they said, you know, I finally got a lawyer in when I was 16, and he said, well, she's going to be married soon anyway, so haha, what did I do? I was dating a guy in high school who I was supposed to marry. He got drafted to Nam, and I thought, okay, you know, I'm going to have a nice station wagon, white picket fence, everything's going to be fine, and I'll wait for him to come home, and I waited, and I waited, and I waited. Two whole months must have gone by, and he wasn't back from the war. And that's when the tortured poet on the motorcycle came by. And I jumped on the back of that baby, and we ran away to Greenwich Village, and that was the Magical Mystery Tour, my friends. That was the whole psychedelic 60s, and it was just absolute insanity, absolute insanity. I got to the point where we moved up to Mamaroneck, and we're living in an attic apartment. And, you know, I took LSD to find God, but I couldn't even find the kitchen. And that's mainly because we didn't have a kitchen. But, you know, we didn't need things like that. I got to the point where I couldn't really speak anymore. I was a vegetable. People would ask me, how are you? And I didn't know what the right answer was. My husband would dress me and put me in a corner, and then I'd have a suicide attempt. And then he'd say to me, well, you know, the life of a worm is better than no life at all. And that's the self-esteem I had. That kept me alive. Thinking that over and over and over in my head kept me alive for another week. And that's how I lived, just trying to find one bit of hope after another. But my old friend came and saved me. I got my hands on a bottle of Wild Turkey. 101 proof, yes! I knew what the answer was to how are you. I'm fine. And the Wild Turkey worked for me, and I decided I had to get away from all these crazy people. So I moved to California. And the 60s in California was very interesting. Also, Red Mountain wine was $1.49 a gallon, and I lived with a lot of students who had people who actually sent them to school. You know, I didn't know how you did that. How do you go to school? How do you go to college? How do you do these things? So I just watched them. And I would say about once a month, my life was in danger. And it was just the way that I lived. A friend of mine, one of my roommates, we got in the car, and we were going to see Jimi Hendrix in Monterey. We ran out of gas, and a madman with a gun picked us up. And, you know, this was just what happened. We drove up to the... He had us in the car in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and he stopped at a stop sign. Now, he doesn't mind, you know, raping and killing us, but he doesn't want to break the traffic laws. So I jumped out of the car, and he looked at me, and he said, if you don't get back in the car, I'm going to blow her brains out. And I'm there, and I'm like this tough New York girl. I've got my bomber jacket on and my sunglasses. And she's about 5 foot nothing, tiny little blonde curls. And I look at her, and I get back in the car. And, you know, I have had angels watching out for me my whole life. And when he let us out of the car with the gun pointed at my back, I just kept falling down. I've had so much fear in my life, just falling down. I finally found a house in the dark that let us in. And, you know, and then this little five-year-old boy comes and he wants to play ball with me. And the extremes of my life have always been, the only way I could deal with them was with alcohol. I stayed in bed for 3 weeks. All my friends just kept bringing me bottles of wine. That's how, if I wasn't drinking, I was on my way to a drink and or in the middle of a drink. And I didn't know how much my life revolved around alcohol until I stopped. About a month later, when I finally did get out of bed, I went hiking in Big Sur, jumped off a cliff and broke my back, and was in the hospital, and I was detoxing, which I didn't know that's what was happening to me. And it took me about 3 days until I heard about a girl down the street, down the ward, who could get me some wine. And then, so the party began. What happened after that? I moved up to Eureka, where the students went, because they migrated up there for the summer. And I was down to my last bottle of wine, walking down the road, didn't know what I was going to do. And this gentleman said to me, "Well, would you like to move in with me, Snow?" I said, "Sure, great idea." And about a week later, he asked me to water his garden with him. Well, we went to water his garden, and it was quite an illegal garden. And three policemen jumped out of the bushes, and we had us on the road, and he said, "Snow, how'd you like to go back to New York?" He whispers in my ear. I said, "I'd love to." He said, "Start running." So I'm here to tell you, I've never been to a detox, a treatment center, a jail, or a psychiatric ward yet. And mostly because I ran fast. Nobody ever took me. And I didn't get caught. And I'm really grateful for that, because I think that they would have locked me up and thrown the key away. I came back, and I always thought that things outside of me were going to make me better. First of all, I thought that when trouble happened, it was the kind of drink that I needed to change. When I had concentrated orange juice and gin at the drive-in theater at 14 with my friend Eric, I thought it was the gin. So I never drank gin again. When I had a Manhattan and I barfed all over the bride, I knew it was the Manhattans. You know, I didn't drink Manhattans again. I always thought it was the kind of alcohol, not the alcohol itself that was damaging my life. And then I thought the outside things are going to do it for me. I got a job and became a director of promotion of an ad agency in about a year and a half after I started as a receptionist. And I got the outside thing going on. It was always a different outfit, different kind of people, different music. I moved in with a girlfriend from high school, threw the Bob Dylan records away, got the Paul Anka records out, started dating the married men like her. You know, the outside stuff. And then after that, I took out a bank loan and bought furniture. Well, the furniture is going to straighten me out. It was always going to be something outside of me that would do it. It was going to be money. It was going to be an education. I went to school for 3 weeks. I had hepatitis. I couldn't go anymore. The night of my last drunk wasn't, there were no blue lights. There was no big traumatic thing. There was only my ex-husband and my bookkeeper in my apartment bouncing off the walls. And I had said maybe 20 times that night, "I don't want to drink tonight. I don't want to drink tonight." And I couldn't not drink. And that was my last drunk. And I thought up until that very last night, I could stop anytime I wanted to. I got that blessed moment of clarity where I knew it had me, I didn't have it. And if you're here tonight, you've had that moment. Hold on to it with all your might, because it is the beginning of a brand new life. When I was 19, my doctor told me I needed to go to AA. So I had heard that information previously. And I came to AA, and getting sober was the hardest thing I ever had to do in my life. I don't want to ever do it again. I don't have whatever it takes to do it again. I was told you only have to do it once. And one of the people who loved me and held me and invested time and energy in me is sitting here someplace tonight. Where are you, John? I love you. I haven't seen John in almost 30 years, and he came tonight. Your love was not in vain, my friend. I detoxed sitting at the tables. I shook. I tore up the coffee mugs. I tore up the styrofoam cups. I had piles sitting there. I had uncontrollable spasms of my arms and my legs. I detoxed right there. The old men with no teeth who drank Sterno told me, you only got to do this once, kid. Just don't drink for tonight. Just don't drink for the next half hour. You only have to do it once. And I believe them. And I have believed people in this program ever since. And nobody steered me wrong yet. About 2 weeks passed, and a guy came in, and he was shaking as much as I was, and he'd sat next to me. And no, he was sitting outside, and my sponsor said to me, go over and say hello to him. I said, what am I supposed to say? I don't even know where I am yet. She said, well, you didn't have a drink for 2 weeks. It's 2 weeks longer than him. Go shake his hand. So I went over to him, and I said, hi. He said, can I kiss you? Now, I don't know if I want this AA thing, but I don't want to blow it, if this is what you're supposed to do. Meantime, it's 1975, I've got platform shoes, I got hot pants on, I've got a gauze shirt, and, you know, I said to my sponsor, what should I do, Petra? She said, kiss him. I said, okay, I kissed him. So Lenny sat next to me every night. The table was levitating between the two of us, how much we were shaking. And about 3 weeks passed, and I came to that meeting that night, and Lenny wasn't there. And I said, what happened to Lenny? Where's Lenny? And they said, Lenny hung himself last night. And I stayed sober that night for me and for Lenny. And I understood how serious this disease is. You don't have to drink for it to kill you. It wants you bad. It wants me bad. It's out there in the parking lot doing push-ups, waiting for me. It's as strong as my sobriety. And I kept coming back, and then I said to John, you know, all these guys are following me all around. I was in my 20s. You know, what am I going to do? They're just driving me nuts. He said, buy a bra. I did. You know, my life was always in my head, my fantasy world. I'd go to bed with James Bond and wake up with Daffy Duck. You know? It was always a different thing going on here. I wanted this magical man to come into a bar and find me and discover me and tell me who I was and how wonderful I was and have a family. And I only drank in gay bars. Getting into reality was tough. It was really tough. But I had fantastic sponsors, and I still have fantastic sponsors. I've been able to do all the things little girls dream of doing. I have been able to. And we don't promise you here that you'll do anything, but if you don't drink, you won't get drunk. But I have been able to go to college. I went to a doctor after about a year to try to get some funding for school. And he said, man, you got a borderline personality disorder. You got, you're bipolar and something else I don't remember. And my sponsor had told me, stay away from anybody who makes you feel like drinking. And when I came out of that guy's office, I wanted to get stewed to the Mickey. So I didn't go back. And I wasn't required to go back for another year. And I went back a year later, and he said to me, you're a different person. What'd you do? I said, I didn't drink and I went to meetings. Even those with grave emotional problems can recover if they have the capacity to be honest. The 12 steps are the exit from total insanity. I remember going to meetings thinking that I'm too crazy for this thing. It's never going to work. I was standing out in the lobby at 7 months sober at the Mamaroneck meeting thinking I am totally insane. It'll never work for me. I'll just go for another 10 minutes. And I went to the meeting for another 10 minutes. I was okay when I came out. You know, one more night in my pocket. I went on welfare so I could go to college, and I got hit by a car after the first year. Was incapacitated for about 14 months, and my sponsors taught me that I could still survive and I could do anything I needed to do. I did get back. I paid welfare back every dime, paid it forward. I got a scholarship too, and I went to Paris. I graduated from Parsons School of Design. I went to Parsons in Paris, and I could tell you that I don't think that anybody in welfare is going to Paris anymore, but they did pay my rent while I was there. I've had miracles happen in my life. I mean, I sat at meetings on the Seine and just pinched myself. How could this happen to me? I graduated. Graduation day, I have a picture of my parents and myself standing there. I'm in my red cap and gown. I had gotten married. I had twins in my belly, and I'm standing there in a red cap and gown, and my parents, the look on their face is, how did she get here? How did she get here? They hadn't a clue. It's all because of Alcoholics Anonymous. All because of it. I had been blessed. I'm married 27 years. Yes, you can't stay married in sobriety. To the same man. He is a social drinker. He calls Jack Daniel's sipping whiskey. Now, I can't pass an iced tea without draining the glass. What's up with sipping whiskey, you know? But God love him. I have raised a family. I have three beautiful children who are just incredible. My twins are 26. The baby's 23. She just graduated. They've all gone to college. She's going to law school. You know, I've had incredible things happen to me, but I've had horrible things happen to me, too. And I want to talk about one of the horrible things, because these are crazy times. And at one point, I built a mansion, lived in a beautiful mansion in Florida. I still live in Florida. And we had our happily ever after going on there. And we decided to do a project with a next door neighbor who lived in a $2.5 million house. And it was a restaurant project. We've had a couple of four-star restaurants. And this was, we had to get to the finish line. By the time we got to the finish line to open this place, we were broke. So we took in this partner and made it happen. And it was a phenomenal home run. Phenomenal home run. Right out of the box. And he decided he needed to have all the money. And it was a total, complete success and a total failure at the same time. Because what happened to us was we lost everything. We lost our home. I had a sponsee. Now, my children, I know how to be poor, but my children were raised in Boca Raton. They don't know how to be poor. They were little. They didn't know what was happening. One of my sponsees let me have a garage sale at her house, and they would sell their little toys, ripped my guts out. And we didn't even have enough money to move out of the house. I had to walk away from this incredible mansion that I had built. The devastation and the pain was unbelievable. The cars were taken away, and I had one car left, and I was commuting up to Palm Beach, running an art gallery up there, and about 11 o'clock at night, police stopped me, and the taillight was out on the car, and I didn't have any of the necessary papers. They towed the car away, and I just sat there and wept. I just sat there and wept. I couldn't believe something else was happening to me. And I got home, and I called the only person who was awake. We were in one tiny little apartment, the five of us, that we just were. I had a four-star restaurant, and I was feeding the kids hard-boiled eggs. And it was beyond comprehension to me. I had one friend awake in California, and I called her, and she said, change the channel. I'm sending you a plane ticket. So I ran away from home. 20-something years sober friends, I ran away from home because I didn't want to drink. I wanted to die. I didn't know how to take care of my family. My husband was paralyzed. He couldn't believe that this had happened to us. And I get on the plane. I'm on the plane about a half an hour, and the plane starts going down. No warning. People start flying in the air. Coffee's flying all over the place. The guy next to me is barfing. People are saying goodbye to their kids. And I'm praying that, God, please don't let me die with this poison on my soul. Please help me to forgive this man who did this to my family before I die. Because I got a program. I got a program. And I know that my relationship with my higher powers, the only thing that's going to ever save me. I start saying the serenity prayer. I start saying the prayer from my childhood. Hail Mary, full of grace. Bless us now and at the hour of our death. Amen. I start saying the Our Father. I'm saying a sober rosary. I'm saying every prayer I know. They make an emergency landing, and my husband and my kids see me on TV. And I crawled to the phone, and I remembered something that a woman said at a meeting once. I think everything we hear at a meeting, we still have in there someplace. Her husband had died in a restaurant, and they asked her if she wanted whiskey, and she said, no, thanks. And I thought to myself, this isn't that bad. I thought of that woman that day. When they asked me, they were giving out free booze to everybody. They asked me, what do you want? I said, I'll have a hot tea, please. And I felt like that tiny bubble from the bottom of my soul started to rise, and I knew I could start my life over. I got this. When in any long-term relationship, there's not good days and bad days. There's good years and bad years. I finally got to a phone, and I said, "I can't. I just had this plane accident, and I'm stunned. I'm in shock." And he said, "Better you than me." This was not one of the good years. But I have been able to do everything that I have ever dreamed. Last year, I had an architectural company. I did huge carved ornamental ceilings. I worked for all kinds of wonderful people. I retired from that, and I travel a lot now. I have a tiny little travel agency. This drunken Puerto Rican from the Bronx actually got to see the Sistine Chapel last year. My mind is blown with how good it keeps getting. I stay in the middle of the pack. The 12 steps are really simple. The first four steps, you talk to yourself. The fifth step, you talk to one other human being. The seventh step, you talk to God, any God. The ninth step, you talk to all the people who you really, really hurt. By the 12th step, you're talking to God and all the other people on the planet. It's the end of isolation. It's the end of dancing alone with the devil. It's over. It's over. And we all have the map now. The 12 steps is the map. No matter what happens, I know I don't have to drink. No matter who lives or dies, I know I don't have to pick up a drink. Thank you so very much for listening.